Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
This is Dr. Peter Bregan talking again to my wonderful audience and the tens of thousands of downloads we've had of the show. Just makes my heart sing. One of the things I'm going to be doing a little bit more as we go along, probably not today, I have such a special guest, is the people have said, why don't you talk a little more? We love your guests, and you really orient around your guests. You're practically a therapist with your guests. I just try to bring out the best of my guests. But they said they want to hear more from me. And we're going to be moving in the direction of kind of my speaking for a little bit more in the beginning and then having the guest on for maybe half an hour, 35 minutes. Just want to let you know that that's a direction we're thinking about going in. And probably will be. We're going to be making a number of changes in how we reach out to the world that I think are going to be very, very positive. Now, you know that I have my book out on psychiatric drug withdrawal, and that's the book that's the most important right now, and I think it's a book, in a way for all time. But I do want to let you in on a secret, and I think Ginger's told me not to do this. It's bad PR to do two books at once. But my book that comes out in December, which is a real breakthrough book, it's called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Overcoming, Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. You can get really cheap on Amazon. Like $15.50, a really quality book way in advance. It's December we're talking about, and it's already up to my shock and surprise on Amazon. I think the publisher's really excited about the book. It has a whole new approach to understanding the evolution of guilt, shame, and anxiety, how it does us in, and how we can overcome it. But I'm not going to say much more than that, just tweak you about that. Interesting phenomena going on. You know, when the drug companies first started coming out with long-term injectable drugs, my first thought was, we are going to be having disasters. Why isn't the FDA thinking about this? One of the great blessings of a drug whose half-life in your body, you know, where only half the substance remains in the day, and it gets halved, and pretty soon most of it's gone. One of the blessings of a drug like that is if you get a severe reaction to it, you can stop the drug. But what about a drug that lasts 4 months in your body? What happens when you have a severe reaction to that? Well, Johnson & Johnson, who gave us Risperdal, the drug that causes gynecomastia in children and obesity in children and elevates their cholesterol and does all that in adults too, and it's shortening the lifespans of people. That marvelous company now, you know, has given us Invega Sustenna, which is not yet here in the U.S. It lasts 4 months in your body at significant amounts. It's calculated to work for 3 months. The drug is being used in Japan. They got 17 deaths there already on that drug, and from a variety of causes. Well, these are very potent drugs. They afflict the nervous system, the cardiovascular system. They cause diabetes. They cause pancreatitis. And we've learned here that they didn't do the full length in the trials that are going on in the U.S. where it hasn't been approved yet. Because their independent monitoring committee said the drug was doing well, so well they didn't have to continue the controlled trials as long as planned. It's wonderful, this independent monitoring committee. And that's what you read in the business papers. well, who's the independent monitoring committee? Well, it belongs to Johnson & Johnson. Big surprise. That's how independent it is. It's set up by Johnson & Johnson and the subsidiary Janssen. So listen, folks, it's bad enough to take a drug anytime for any purpose. They all have side effects. You want to be careful. You want to know it's going to good chance of doing good. But avoid drugs if you can, even in the general medical field, whose effects are going to last for 3 or 4 months because you can't get it out of your system. For example, Invega causes diabetes. Well, as soon as you start getting an acute diabetic attack, you're going to want to get that drug out of your system, but you won't be able to. It's going to stay in there for a period of 3 to 4 months, whether you like it or not, while people try to keep you from dying from diabetes. Or tardive dyskinesia, and they, of course, tardive dyskinesia, that horrible movement disorder, it disfigures children and adults and causes abnormal movements that can disable you. And some of them are really horrifically painful, spasms of the neck and akathisia, which is like being tortured from the inside out. So these drugs are causing all of this, and the blessing of the older drugs, at least you could stop them, and within a day or two, you weren't being intoxicated anymore. You had a chance for recovery. But if you develop tardive dyskinesia on Invega Sustaina when it's approved in the U.S., your doctor isn't going to be able to stop the drug. You're going to suffer for 3 or 4 months, and that's going to make your tardive dyskinesia worse and even permanent, and everything I tell you is scientifically true. It simply is true. So this is a part of my talking a little more, but it's only 7 minutes or 8 minutes. Thomas D. Ryan, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Tom. My guest today is just a lovely human being. Forget that he's a doctor. He's a treasure. He's a pediatrician. He's in private practice in Cartersville. He's been there since 2002. That's South Carolina, I hope.
No, it's Georgia. Oh, it's north of
it's
Atlanta.
Georgia. Ah, yeah. You know, I thought Georgia, and I happen to have a camera crew in the office here that's taking a break while they're filming me, and they've been talking to you, and they thought South Carolina. I thought Georgia. Well,
yeah.
I've got to come visit you. You've got to invite me in. Well, Ginger doesn't travel much, so we probably won't get down there. Well, Tom is a pediatrician. He actually went to college at Syracuse University and did bioengineering, which is really a high intelligence major and probably ahead of his time back in '88.
Huh.
And he finished his pediatric residency at the Children's Medical Center at Stony Brook in 1996. Now, this, folks, is the first and only person I can say this about. Tom Ryan, by the way, who is married and has 6 children and is a deeply spiritual and religious man. And I'm going to say something I'm not able to say about anybody I know of else in the U.S.
Oh, no.
I don't think so. Do you know another pediatrician who's done what you've done?
Uh-huh.
Okay, then you'll tell us about him. I'm going to learn about another one or two then, maybe. Tom Ryan decided on scientific, medical, moral, pediatric grounds that it was the wrong thing to be giving out stimulant drugs to children, diagnosing them with ADHD, and giving them stimulant drugs. And he decided to explore the possibility of not doing this. This is remarkable, and the outcome is remarkable. And I want to give the mic over now, after having made about 3 stumbles and errors, to this marvelous man, Thomas D. Ryan, from Cartersville in Georgia, pediatrician. Tom, how did you get started on this miraculous idea that you weren't going to be pushing stimulant drugs anymore?
Well, thank you. Thank you for your comments. That's very kind, Peter. I can't take much credit. I mean, I've got to give a lot of it back to you. But let me back up a little bit. I've been a pediatrician for 20 years, almost 20 years in private practice. It never set well with me to be prescribing, but, you know, I got into the middle of the stream, so to speak, and, you know, it's kind of the way it's done, and there is some apparent, you know, benefit to it with the children sitting still more. And so, I was in this practice of prescribing, you know, stimulants for these behaviors. Never comfortable with it, however. And last year, my brother is a doctor. He read one of your books. Well, he's read a number of your books, but I think it was Toxic Psychiatry that he read. And he knew of your book on ADHD, the Ritalin Fact book, and he gave me that book last year. And I think I read it in one night. You know, my jaw hit the table, and that was really what pushed me over the edge to make this decision. It was just, I knew it was right. You know, I knew everything in your book was not new to me, but you said it in a great way and very confidently. And so that's what pushed me, you know, over the edge to make this decision. I think the next day I wrote a letter to all my patients, you know, telling them my plans to wean them off the medication and help them if they want to see a different doctor. But that was a year ago. And I gave them 6 months. Some of the patients I would wean over 6 months, but so in the past 6 or 8 months, I have no patients on these stimulants. And the response has really surprised me. At least half of the patients, right off the bat, were very much in agreement to do this. They like, oh, great, you know. I mean, and I expected a lot more backlash, but I would say at least half were very happy to just, you know, go along with this plan right away. You know, maybe one fourth of them didn't want to do it and ended up finding different doctors, and the other ones have stopped, but then over time decided that they would, you know, want to go back on those medications and have found another doctor for that. But you know, a lot of people stopped. With nothing, you know, I haven't heard from them since. You know, the schools haven't been calling, the moms haven't been calling back. And then since that time, new patients that want to discuss this, I'm prepared for that. And I have, you know, developed some better counseling skills, getting more to the root of what really is the problem with the behavior. And I think, and I haven't, you know, everybody that I've talked to since then, I've been able to work through them with their family or whatever to not go down this path.
Well, this is amazing, obviously. Now, the patients who went elsewhere to get medication, did they stay with you as their pediatrician, or did they leave your practice?
Well, some do and some don't. You know, with the way that primary care arrangement is and insurance and stuff, some could stay with me and they could find a psychiatrist that would take their insurance. And then others, you know, there would be no psychiatrist that would take their insurance. They'd have to find another primary care pediatrician. Most stimulants, and I'm sure you know this, but most stimulants are prescribed by pediatricians. The psychiatrists, you know, do it too, you know, much more in terms of how many prescriptions they write and that kind of thing. But overwhelming amount of the stimulants for ADHD are prescribed by pediatricians, and the patients have a primary pediatrician that they're assigned to. So it was some of each.
And how have you been helping folks? Do a lot of them just not need any help? They're just okay when the kids come off? Or?
No, I think I've been most helpful with listening. Listening to the history and asking the right questions and really exploring the family. I mean, in my experience, the family is what you have to treat, and actually you got to treat the parents. I mean, I go to the parents, and most of the time that's where the issue is. Teaching the parents that they actually need to change in order for the child to change. The child is. You know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? So I really focus on the parents, and if there's a dad in the family, I focus most on the father, honestly. Anger, impatience, you know, the parents often have behaviors that are hyperactive. Their lives are stressful. And so that's where I go with my treatment.
What I find a lot is that parents, even fathers, just don't believe in their moral authority anymore.
Oh, yes.
Makes sense to you?
I was taking some notes, and I put that very concept as at the top of my note. Confidence in their moral authority is so true. There's a passivity that so many people have adopted with child rearing. They don't have the confidence, I guess. I think they know what's right, but they may not have the confidence to implement it. But the children respond to that. I mean, the children, you know, the philosophy of ADHD, it almost makes us want to think of the child as a kind of a miniature psychopath. You know, he just can't control it. He doesn't really have a heart. He doesn't really care about sitting still. He doesn't care about, you know, doing the right thing. He just can't control himself. And that has, you know, pervaded how parents think about it. But it's not true. It's absolutely not true. I mean, these boys and girls, when they come to my office and we have these discussions, I can very quickly talk to them. You know, talk. We can talk to them and you know, get into their heart, have them recognize that what they're doing is hurtful to their parents, and have the parents recognize that they need to, you know, impress upon the child, you know, the importance of following through. And when the parents recognize their mistakes and they start changing, the kids definitely respond to that. But confidence in the moral authority, I think that you hit the nail on the head with that. I think that is probably the number one attribute I try to instill with the parents.
Yeah, I've really noticed that. I'm in a college community now for the last 10 or 12 years here in Ithaca. We have Cornell and Ithaca College, and very, very educated people. And they have these very relativistic views. They're almost afraid to teach morality to their children, teach ethics to them, or to act like authorities. And when I start to talk to one of these parents, they'll say, well, if I say to little Timmy, you know, you need to be respectful to me and your mom, he won't listen. I said, well, he won't listen if you don't believe he will. Mm-hmm. But we're going to work on you getting the idea that that's your job in life, that you're supposed to be empowered to teach morality to your kids. And when you get that idea, it's going to show in your face, your posture. You'll be less angry. You'll be less emotionally unstable. You'll just be firm and loving at the same time. And people are amazed after practicing this for a few days that their kids catch on, that they're expected.
Yeah.
Most of the children, that they're expected to listen. They feel better. They feel less anxious. Kids who don't have themselves surrounded by adult authority get very frightened and frantic, because they can't control themselves, and they know it, and that's terrifying.
That's right.
Now, how much time do you spend chatting with a family?
With a new patient, it probably goes to an hour. We usually schedule them at the end of the morning, and it would run over into the lunch hour, and my staff can leave. And you know, it's usually an hour. Often it goes longer, and I don't mind at all, because if the parents are listening and you know, they want to work through this and talk about it and try to get some advice from me on how to implement this, you know, I'll spend a lot of time with them. It's very enjoyable. It's very enjoyable. I try to get both parents to come to the initial meeting, and that's very helpful. But the first visit is usually that long, and follow-up visits, I don't have that many. I mean, if I really do a good job in the first visit, often I don't hear from them again. You know, I don't hear from them again. Or that follow-ups will be shorter, you know, half an hour.
But you will keep track of these kids to some degree, right, because they're coming in for the regular pediatric checkups?
Yeah, I should do a better job of systematically keeping track of them. I see these days, you know, since all my patients that were on these medicines aren't, you know, I don't do that anymore. These days I see my job more as preventative. I mean, I kind of start these discussions much sooner, you know, two-year-old visits, you know, 18-month-old visits. Yeah, and my antenna is up for, you know, the things I notice. You can notice a lot in a medical visit. You know, I see them when they're born and then 2 months and get to know them and how the, even those moments they're in the office, how they communicate, how the kid responds to mom. And I'll interject, you know, a lot of these principles at the young age. So hopefully, you know, hopefully I'm doing some work with prevention, you know, prevention of.
So you're helping the child learn respect and you're helping teach the parent to require respect?
Yeah, I would say most of my work, honestly, is with the parents actually learning respect for each other and how they communicate.
Yes.
The child just follows what the parents do. And so I really just talk to the parents, and I will ask them, you know, is there anger in your home? You know, how do you speak to your husband when there's a conflict? Is there yelling in the house? And if they trust me, you know, they do trust me, and they answer. Mostly the time they answer very honestly, and they say, yeah, yeah, there is. We had a problem with anger. We, you know, we yell a lot, and, you know, we work through that. But if they will admit it, it's really great. It's really great when they admit it, and we can just talk about it, and I recommend some techniques, demonstrate, you know, if you say it in an angry way, how does that make you feel? You know, if you say it in a kind way, how does that make the other person feel? You know, men yell more, right? Men yell and don't really care too much about it. Now, we yell, and it doesn't bother us too much. If another man yells at me, it doesn't. But I tell them, you know, it bothers your wife, and it bothers your kids, so, you know, stop doing that. You find a gentle way to communicate. You're going to get a lot more response from the child if you just calmly explain to him he did something wrong. You don't want him to do that anymore. This is the consequence. But I love you, and, you know, let's do better next time. That's going to work. But if you just get frustrated and yell, which is so common, it doesn't work. It makes the problem much worse. But I think that anger is a big issue with ADD. I think it's huge. Anger in the home, angry communication is a very big contributor to why children behave the way they do. That's, you know, unacceptable at school.
I think that's a very interesting point. And, you know, Tom, I think I probably don't emphasize that enough in my own work.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a learning for me. I think but I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're absolutely right. For one thing, the father's anger will make the mother anxious, will make the child anxious, gives the boy modeling for how to behave.
Right.
It's very disruptive. And you're so right. You know, we men don't realize that when we get angry at the woman we love, it isn't taken lightly. It's very upsetting.
Yeah.
It's very important.
And I've learned it the hard way. I mean, personally, you know, a lot of my learning is also coming from my own life, you know, raising children. We homeschool, and, you know, raising a family is very difficult. Raising a child is, you know, it's a huge responsibility, and it's not easy by any means. And so, you know, a good deal of what I'm learning is through my own personal experience in finding out what works, and that really is good, too. It helps the parents, you know, when they know that I'm going through it, too. It gives me some extra, you know, mm-hmm. authority, I guess, as I discuss it with them.
Yeah, raising children is definitely the hardest job there is, and I'm not just pandering to homemakers in that regard. I mean, raising kids.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you rarely see anybody quit being a physician to have the easier job of raising children. Some of the physicians I have worked with who have stopped practicing, and sometimes because of a disability, and they become full-time parents, they realize that raising children is, in fact, a lot harder than being a physician. But they also find in some ways it's much more satisfying. It really, you do it right, you really have to reach to your resources of being firm and loving at the same time, and you really have to bring out the best in yourself.
Right.
I find with almost all the parents who come to me in this community, they all have a dad attention deficit disorder. I mean, one of the first things that comes out in the first discussion is that the dad is not spending a lot of time alone
right.
with the person who is supposedly out of control. And it's interesting. Sometimes we'll be sitting in the family, and the father will say, well, you know, Jane doesn't want to spend time with me. George doesn't want to spend time with me. And I'll look over, and clearly the child is holding back. Yes, I do. And mm-hmm. I'll say, well, what do you feel about it? Oh, I want to spend time with Dad. Now, he doesn't necessarily want to go and hang around the hardware store in the corner for half an hour while Dad looks at stuff he wants for the garden. He's going to want to be doing something right. with Dad that's meaningful and is social, where they relate to each other. But that attention deficit disorder is what these kids are suffering from. I mean, in your community, I imagine, and maybe not as bad as in the urban centers, but a lot of single women are trying to raise boys on their own. And, boy, that's such a disadvantage for them in our culture. Is that your experience?
Yeah, very, very much so. The common thing with that is relates to ADD, you know, and I'm just using, you know, what I mean by that word. I mean, we don't believe in that really, but it, you know, it encompasses the other behavior that we're familiar with.
Undisciplined children.
Yeah, but the single moms, I find that so often they want to compensate. They feel bad that that's happened to the child, and they try to be more of a friend, to be quote nice all the time to the child, indulge them, and they're really reluctant to make rules, you know, to say no to them, to be firm with them. And I tell the mom, I said, you know, do it the other way, be firm. You're not going to lose your child. You know, he'll love you more, he'll respect you more, and he'll actually be more secure in his world if he knows there's rules, if he knows that there's strict rules and that you're in control. That's going to help him. That's going to help him a lot more than being the boss all the time. But with single moms, that's really common, that they will, you know, they think that they're being loving and kind of being nice to him by indulging what they want.
That was a very hard thing for me to learn. You know, I grew up in the 60s and didn't grow up in the 60s, but I was having children in the 60s rather. And maybe I hadn't even grown up yet. It's very hard to grow up, as I'm sure you would agree, when you're going through your medical training and your residency training. You sort of stay ungrown up for a while. But I really had to learn that my kids and other kids need firmness, need authority, that it makes them feel safer. But as you're emphasizing, not angry authority and not punitive authority, but a father and a mother who know what they're doing and insist to begin with on respect in the family. Once you create an atmosphere of respect, everything else flows. Everything else can happen.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different things. We're going to go to break in a minute. When we come back, some of the things maybe I'd like to talk about with you. First of all, I think homeschooling six children is a very interesting challenge. I want to hear what's happened to your pediatric practice as a result of your taking these different positions. How do you earn a living when you're spending some time talking for an hour with people rather than drugging six kids in a row in an hour? Whether you use other resources like other books or tapes or send people to tell them to, you know, go to the county family training program there that they usually have in the county where, you know, they take a parenting program. And talk more in general about all this to sponsor your colleagues are giving to you. And you implied there was at least one other pediatrician doing the same thing. So when we come back from break, let's try to cover some of those topics and anything else that you want to talk to. I'm talking with Thomas D. Ryan, in solo practice, pediatrician in Cartersville, Georgia, and a really, really lovely human being. Let's go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. I've had quite a week or two. I've got a camera crew in here right now, and a week ago I was filmed for the second version of a very good film, American Addict, And it did very, very well on Netflix, and 800,000 people or so downloaded it there. It looks like millions have actually seen it. And as I think I may have mentioned, it looks like I was much appreciated. People liked what I was saying. So of the, I don't know, many, many talking heads, I'm one of the two that's coming back for the second version. They filmed me last week. And now Generation RX, my friend Kevin Miller, they're doing a new film. And once again, a follow-up called Letters from Generation RX, because Kevin got so many, many letters talking about his film and the effect it had on him and the lives of these children. So he's doing a follow-up, I'm really proud that he's coming back this week to film me on that. We're doing a lot of shows in this last month or so on children. And so it's so appropriate to welcome back Tom Ryan. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Peter.
Any thoughts on where you'd like to begin here? I sort of threw out a bunch of topics.
Well, I was thinking on the break, I wanted to say, I mean, people may be listening thinking, well, I thought they were going to talk about ADD. I thought they were talking about stimulants, and all they've been talking about is parenting. But the point I would like listeners to understand is this quote, epidemic of ADD. And it's been in the news recently. You know, I think they came out with a new statistic, 1 in 8 boys, 3.5 million children on stimulants or more. It is what we're talking about. The children that are getting put on stimulants, yes, they have hyperactivity, they have inattention at school, but it's used for a lot more than that. I mean, it's used for anger. It's used for, almost any behavior a child has. If you go to any doctor, a pediatrician or pediatric psychiatrist, you will be automatically put on a stimulant, no matter what, no matter what the behavior complaint is. So I wanted to make that point about the current state of our healthcare system and how children complaints are handled these days. It's that's where the prescriptions are coming from. So I wanted to make that point. I also see patients that come to me because I have a little bit of a reputation now. They may come to me because they're on a bunch of drugs, and they want to know what I recommend they do to get off, and it's just horrific what some of these doctors are doing. The numbers of medications that they're on, I'm going to call them medications, the drugs that they're on, and then I'll go back and say, now what was the problem that he would get these drugs for? And it's basically tantrums and not wanting to follow with what the parents say, and he has a rage attack and he slams the door. And they would go to the doctor, and he's already on one drug, and they'll say, well, okay, let me give you a drug for, he sounds like you're bipolar, let me give you a different drug. And you come back later, well, he's not sleeping well, he's got these tics, well, let me give you something else. And I see that quite a bit, too. So that's one thing I thought of, on the break, to emphasize about what we're talking. It's the whole healthcare system. Yeah, the whole healthcare system is treating, it's almost inhuman. It's like they're treating children like they're animals, or like they're just a collection of chemicals. And if we just, in medical school, we learn about antibiotics, right? You've got an infection. Well, we've got a culture here. It shows that you've got a germ. It's sensitive to penicillin. Okay, let's give penicillin. Oh, another germ. It's sensitive to a different animal. Let's give another. They're treating behavior like that, as if you can parse out conduct disorder from hyperactivity, from as if it's, some kind of separate chemicals that are going on, going awry in the child's body, rather than understand, well, it's all connected. It's all connected. And what is that connection? The psychiatrists, I get the reports, right? I get the old records, and I see the histories they take. And, it might be that mother was a drug addict 2 years ago. It might be that dad was in jail. They don't even know that. What I mean? They don't even know. Psychiatrists don't even know that. They don't even ask about that stuff. So
isn't
it's
that
treating,
bizarre?
Yeah, it's, they're treating the child as if it's all him, as if it's just his chemicals that are wrong. So I wanted to mention that.
Let me elaborate a little bit on that. I mean, first of all, it simply comes down to it's all in the family. If your kid's upset, It's all in the family. And
yeah.
if the injury is from outside the family, maybe the kid's been sexually abused by a babysitter or the coach or humiliated by a teacher or bullied in the schoolyard, it's still up to the family to figure it out and provide the solutions and to support the child.
Yeah.
Family life. It's all about family life. And whether or not the family's caused the problem, the family holds the solution. No one else
Absolutely.
Holds the solution.
And yeah.
I want to say a word about the stimulus. I'm so glad you brought that up. Just very briefly, folks, the reason why that these drugs like Adderall and Concerta and Focalin and Dexedrine and so on, the reason they can be given to all these different kinds of children is the same reason they could be given to a chimpanzee for the same purpose. They simply crush spontaneous behavior. We have very good studies of animals, including chimps, showing that the usual clinical dose of these drugs suppresses all the natural spontaneous behaviors of a chimp, whether it's grooming, playing, wrestling, trying to escape from the cage, smiling, all the spontaneous behaviors are reduced. And then compulsive behaviors like picking your skin and playing with pebbles are increased. So studies show the same things in children. We are just making good cage children by crushing their spontaneity. We may crush it a little. We may crush it a lot. It's partly dose dependent. It's partly dependent on the kid and his environment. But basically, you're suppressing overall creativity, imagination, sociability, all the great things about being a child are being suppressed. And they're being replaced with obsessive behaviors like, you know, tell the kid to mow the lawn and he'll mow the lawn until he drops over, tell him to rake the lawn. One of the scientific studies, you know, they told the kid to rake the leaves and 2 hours later they found him waiting for leaves to fall off the trees to rake them. And this is what the drugs do, and they only do it for a few months because the brain fights back, and that's why, for example, the studies for Adderall last only 3 weeks. Because Adderall XR, because after 3 weeks, the brain's fighting back and you get more and more trouble. You put the kid on more and more drugs to treat the trouble you've caused with the stimulants. And you have a career then of mental patients. And just finally, one more word about it. Ginger and I now have been looking at this literature that follows up so-called mildly hyperactive kids from the 70s. Study was used as a model for getting everybody on ADHD drugs. And in fact, what's happened is that the 40-year-olds now who've been on these drugs since childhood have, compared to the children seen in hospitals at the same time and not put on these drugs, these kids have higher crime rates, they have higher addiction rates, they have higher suicide rates, they become lifelong psychiatric patients, and they have shrinkage of the brain on the MRI.
Hmm.
And all of this comes because it's not from the few years they were just on the Ritalin, although that will do some things to you, like make you prone to cocaine addiction. But it's really the creation of the lifelong mental patient that many of these kids become, and it ruins their lives and their brains and their quality of lives, and it's shortening lifespan. We just got to start saying it out right now, Tom, because we got the studies. And I summarize a lot of these studies in Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal Book. But back, giving the mic back to you.
Well, the patients never stay on one dose. The dosage always goes up. You know, when I used to prescribe them, I mean, they would always go up on the dose. You have to. You know, after a few months, you get a call. You know, it's not working. Teacher says thus and such. So the dosage always goes up over time, and then you end up changing a drug because it's not working anymore. So I'm just echoing with what you said, that is absolutely true. Nobody gets on 5 milligrams and stays on it, and then they're fine. It never happens. And the other thing that you mentioned, you know, lifelong patients, you know, I'm a pediatrician. One of the great joys of pediatrics is you're taking care of a patient at an age when their body heals itself. You know, we don't really have chronic sick. We have some, you know, but children generally recover, and it's great. You know, it's a really nice job in that way. You can see a patient, give them a medicine, give them some advice, and then 3 days later the child is better. It's really amazing. The human body heals itself at that age. And so that's my life. But not so with what they're saying about this, you know, disease. It's not something that you can ever heal from. It kind of dooms the person to thinking that they have, and actually saying it now, they're actually saying it, it's a lifelong disease and you need to stay on these drugs through your adulthood. But that really goes against common sense. You know, a child does not need a drug to get through life. And you know, they're at an age where they heal themselves. And, we don't need to go on that path of labeling them. And that's one of the other effects. Outside of the physiological damage of the stimulants, you know, think about a child who's told from age 5 through his teen years, well, you've got a handicap. You know, you can't do this work without seeing the doctor. And he starts to believe that about himself, and his parents believe that about him, his teachers believe that about him. You know, what kind of effect does that have on his life? I mean, it's huge. You know, it could change his whole life. So we should not do that. You know, we should not do that. We want to find the most in a child and help them to reach their potential, and we should not label them in any way as handicapped, because they may think differently, or they may, have a little more flight of ideas. You know, let's use that. Let's use that and find out how you can apply that in a positive way.
I'm in favor of doing away with all psychiatric diagnoses and all psychiatric drugs for children. We need to retake responsibility for our children as parents and as teachers and as ministers and coaches and all the folks that are supposed to be bringing up the kids. We need to retake responsibility and not put them in these categories, because every psychiatric diagnosis says, as you said, that the child's disabled, and it also says the child's not responsible for that behavior, neither are the parents or the teachers. It's like non-responsibility behavior, which is the worst possible thing for everybody involved to feel, that they have no responsibility. Parents give up learning new things about raising their kids when their kid gets diagnosed. Teachers stop figuring out no new ways to teach. Mm-hmm. And the kid figures, that he'll just, get by with accommodations. It's a disaster. And it's not the way it was. You know, my mother-in-law, Jean, Gingy's mom, God bless her, she taught school for 20 years. She never had, in a small town with a number of poor children in it, wasn't there some rich, wealthy town, small town in the Midwest not been doing good for the last 20 or 30 years, and she never had a child, one child in the third grade, that she didn't bring up to grade level in school performance and in teach and in reading, and she never had a child that didn't listen to her. I listened to her, too. Wow. Everybody listens to Jean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the way it once was. That's what my classroom was like when I was growing up. I didn't have unruly children in my classrooms at all, ever. Not even in high school, let alone in the sixth grade. Because we believed that we had a moral role to take as parents and teachers with children. And that was it. And that's what children need. They need that. Let them rebel against it, and then they'll get some more discipline, and they'll learn, they'll struggle with it. And then when they grow up, they'll have a firm sense of their relationship to other people, and they'll be able to make their own independent decisions. But without authority, a moral, loving authority, kids don't grow up with strength.
Right.
So how has it affected your practice as a pediatrician, if you're comfortable talking about that?
Oh, it's been tremendously positive.
Wonderful.
So first of all, for me personally, to stop doing something that I was uncomfortable with is very freeing. It's very freeing. I'm a doctor. I want to be a good doctor. I don't want to be a bad doctor. And when I was prescribing that stuff, I felt like I was just, really wasn't doing the right thing. So it's very fulfilling. It's very fulfilling when I have encounters, and I don't want everybody to think that every encounter is like perfect. I mean, it's hard, and not everybody goes along with this plan, and sometimes things don't work, so there are definitely challenges, but it's very, very fulfilling to have a successful counseling session where you're making progress and really feel like you've really helped the child for his future. So in that sense, it's great. Another positive thing is I don't spend time writing refills. I mean, I used to have to spend a good number of minutes every day writing new scripts every month, you know, because you can't write them for more than a month. So, you know, that's just one practical time saver. And I would say that it had no financial effect on my practice. I don't think I have gotten any kind of bad reputation among people, even the ones that have left. They understood my position, and so I wouldn't say there has been any, you know, negative impact on my practice. Yeah.
You must have been scared it would have a negative impact. It was very brave of you to do this.
I was most afraid that, I'm afraid of criticism, I guess. I wasn't really afraid of anything financial, but I was afraid that the parents would be angry with me and feel like I had abandoned them. But that didn't happen. It didn't happen even once. So,
I hope there are other professionals listening, not just medical docs. If you're a therapist, stop going along with the drugging of your patients. Get courage. Develop a life where you live the way you believe in. It's what Tom is saying is so true. When you start to act on your principles and ethics, life gets so much better. And all the terrible things you thought were going to happen, they don't generally. Now, if you can do what I'm going to do and participate in suing Johnson & Johnson or attack the Psychiatric Association, the AMA, the FDA, and the NIMH, then you have some trouble. But in your routine living of being a decent professional person, you really are not going to get in trouble for doing what's right. Very few therapists, I mean, I haven't heard of one in a long time. I've been sued for telling a patient that, you know, you ought to learn more about the drugs, let's learn about how Xanax is really going to affect you, and from just being responsible therapists, which means you help educate, you learn, you educate your patient. So, folks, one great lesson from this is, this is the most important lesson in life almost, which is if you live by your ideals, actually life tends to get better. And for me, even when life got horrifically terrifying at times, I have felt in the long run that living by my ideals is one of the best things I ever decided to do. So go do it.
Yeah.
Tom, you seem to be suggesting that some other pediatricians or doctors were doing what you're doing, giving up prescribing these drugs?
No, I'm sorry. I didn't say that. I don't know.
You were a prince among doctors. I didn't know another pediatrician in the country changed his mind along the way like you had. I just think that's incredible.
I don't know of any. I don't know of any. I don't know of anybody
else. You don't know
of
any others. I don't know of any others. A question that's a real no-no is in most cases in our lives today is religion, unless you're on a religious program. What role did your religion play in your making a decision like this and also in how you counsel people and think about children? I'd love you to talk about that.
Sure. Well, it's huge. I mean, I'm a Christian. I try to live my life according to the Bible and what Jesus teaches. So, the truth is always going to be something I don't want to compromise on. Kindness, love, patience, these are all attributes that we're to demonstrate to humanity, to our neighbors. So that's a very easy thing for me to promote, you know, with my patients. I don't evangelize directly to my patients in my counseling generally, but if it goes there, then we go there. But I don't make that. I guess I don't feel that that's part of my obligation as a doctor to go there initially. But my Christian faith is definitely the most important thing in my life, and this decision, this way of treating people, respecting people. You know, people are made in God's image. We're not animals. You know, we have control of our morality. Sin is real. You know, we have to face up with things that we do that are sinful. So, you know, applying these things to my work fits very easily.
You know, a lot of people who love my work and love me and who will be listening to this show don't believe that Christians are real.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're humanistically oriented. They think that people living in small towns and going to church on Sunday are hypocrites. And I can tell you, folks, I live in a small town. I'm Jewish. I don't go to church much. Susan goes once in a while. I go with her. People living in small towns and people who believe in Christ, Christianity, they use these ideas in really, really good ways. Mm-hmm. And everywhere I go, some of the strongest support that I get are from deeply faith-oriented Christians. I can't over-exaggerate the amount of support in my work in terms especially of stopping the drugging of children. It comes from people who believe that children are gifts from God,
mm-hmm.
and that they are born with what they need, and it's up to us as parents and professionals to help them. So, you know, at the risk of alienating folks, I'd rather just bring folks together. We need to bring this country together in new ways. But some of the most principled, loving folks are folks who are, in fact, living by their Christian principles. And now, some progressive will say, well, look at all the wars and, you know, the Protestants fighting Protestants. Well, yeah, I know. But look at all the wars based on secular principles,
right,
like communism. And, you know, look at the USSR and look at China and so on and so forth. The most horrendous wars have been based on other than Christian principles in the last century. So, you know, let's open up to each other. And on this show, please keep coming back because you're going to hear people from all sides. And I think one of the uniting factors has to be we love one another. And that comes straight out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that we love one another and we love our children. So there I risk sounding a little bit too much like a minister. Read my books. They're very scientific. I'm a scientist. And this man's a good physician, and we share these beliefs. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left. More thoughts from yourself as we come near the end?
Well, I don't know what to say on this topic as a summary. You know, maybe I can actually, there is a quote I wanted to read. It's a summary on the ADD topic. You know, Dr. Connors.
Yes,
he's like the grandfather of you know, the Connors rating scale and you know, measuring ADD. He
started to recant.
You're right.
Maybe he doesn't want to meet his maker in his present condition.
That's what I wanted to read. Ginger sent me the New York Times articles that were written last year, you know, in the last part of the year by Alan Schwartz. And he quoted Dr. Connors, and this is his quote. This is Connors' quote. "The numbers make it look like an epidemic. Well, it's not. It's preposterous. This is a concoction to justify the giving out of medication at unprecedented and unjustifiable levels." I guess that would be my summary of this problem. It's a concoction. There's a lot of challenges with hyper kids that, you know, but it's a concoction to justify prescriptions. And I would say that's the bottom line of what's going on.
And he's the inventor of it. And Connors is one of the several big-time old boys club people who got lots of money to do the MTA study from NIMH, which looked at kids longitudinally over many years taking stimulant drugs versus kids not taking them versus kids getting other kinds of treatment. They did it in a naturalistic fashion. And lo and behold, and this may have influenced Connors, God bless him for it, but, you know, it came out like it always does. These drugs don't help people.
Yeah, right.
And in fact, they got more help from going one time to a day camp. So it's real, folks. But children and adults, people who are suffering, struggling life, we need one another. We need care and support and love from one another. We need to cross party lines in doing this. I've done that my whole life in my work. We got to cross religion lines in doing this. And we have to find a common denominator that what people really need is love and support and responsible and ethical living, some basic, simple principles. Without them, we all fail. With them, we succeed. Thanks for being on my show, Tom Ryan. You're a prince of a doc. Glad to know you.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.